This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia, the Supreme Court decision that made interracial marriage legal across America. Each episode features a different couple's story about what it's like to be in an interracial marriage. This time, we hear from Jen and Aramius.
Jen is white and grew up in Philadelphia. Aramius is black and Eritrean, although he grew up in neighboring Ethiopia. The couple met in Eritrea in the 1990s and got married there in the year 2000. But it wasn't until 5 years later that Aramius was allowed to leave that country to come to the United States. They now live with their two children in the Mount Airy neighborhood of Philadelphia.
My name is Aramius. I'm Eritrean and I'm black.
My name is Jen and I'm white and American.
And we have two children.
Yona is 10 and Sammy is 6. And we have been married since the year 2000.
We met in Eritrea in 1995. I was a middle school teacher and Jen was a Peace Corps volunteer in Eritrea for high school. The high school and the middle school are not far apart and every teacher knows each other and nearly all the teachers hang out in the same place. That's where we start to see each other.
I'd always wanted to join Peace Corps. My dad was a Peace Corps volunteer. And when he was in the Peace Corps in Kenya, he met my mom, who was there visiting her family, who was working and living there. And so I grew up with a lot of stories about Africa, a lot of family friends from East Africa. So it was somewhere I knew I'd always wanted to go. And then I got a chance to go be part of the first Peace Corps group in Eritrea. It was 4 years after Eritrea gained independence from Ethiopia. And it seemed like too exciting an opportunity to pass up. We were the first Peace Corps volunteers in the school. There was one other Peace Corps volunteer with me. And all of the teachers seemed very shy of talking to us. So we were feeling very lonely in our school until finally one of the teachers started talking to us. And it turned out that he was Aramius's best friend. So that's how we met. We didn't start dating for a while after that, but that's how we got to be friends.
Yeah.
I think we both are people who question things and look at things from different perspectives. I think that was one of the things that, even before we were dating as friends, really attracted me to Aramius, that he had a very open mind about things. He was really curious about the world. He was willing to sort of look at his own prejudices and his own ways that his ways of thinking about things were shaped by his upbringing. And that's something that's always been really important to me also, to question everything, question all of your beliefs, question all of your attitudes. So I think still we're really able to always have really great conversations where we're able to question each other. And sometimes that's painful, but I think we're always able to kind of grow by challenging each other and pointing out where our own worldviews are limited. I was, 25, 26? I don't think you think about anything really long-term when you're 25 or 26, at least I wasn't. I didn't expect that I was going there to find a husband. I wasn't expecting that.
We were not sure about the future, but we were very close. I knew her parents, they were visiting. And then I went to England in 97 summer, and Jen was visiting. She was done with Peace Corps. She went to Kenya, Tanzania, and came back, joined me in England. I think that solidified something for the future. And we were not very happy separating by then, I remember.
We parted in England. Aramius went back to Eritrea, and I came back to the United States. And then we sort of said, we're going to write letters. This was before the internet. So we were going to write letters to each other, and we wrote long letters. We wrote to each other every day and mailed the letters at least 2 times a week. So we have this like huge stack of letters. Then after almost a year, in May 1998, we'd sort of decided this is too much. We'd rather be together. I was still feeling way too young to think about marriage. But I'd been looking into what do you have to do to get someone from another country into the US. I looked into student visas and got a lot of advice saying there's no way he's going to get a student visa. There's no way he's going to get a tourist visa. So I realized I had to marry him or not be together, or move there, which I couldn't do for all kinds of reasons, or not be together. So that's a crazy situation to be put in. You marry someone or you lose them forever. So around May 1998, we decided we'd get married. And that felt risky to me because I felt too young. But we decided to do it anyway. And the only point at which my parents especially were concerned was when they thought that I was just marrying him for out of convenience. And they said, with a lot of wisdom, it can't be a marriage of convenience if it's someone that you actually are in a relationship with. That's not going to work. You have to either decide you're with him or you're not with him. But that was really their only concern through all of this, that I'm sure they were worried about me, but they always just sort of thought this was what I had to do. Now, that might be that my dad travels a lot and travels to places that a lot of people would say are not safe. I tend to think they're safe, but some people would say they're not. And my mom, when she was a pretty young woman, decided to sort of up and leave everything behind and move to Kenya to be with my dad. So there was some precedent for this in my family. So I think that maybe my family is just a little bit crazy and we do things like this. And so none of it seemed particularly unusual for them. And they like him a lot. Eritrea is a country that doesn't allow people to leave until they've undergone mandatory military training. And for various reasons, Hermias didn't want to go through that experience. But his family was still living in Ethiopia. So the plan was for him to go visit his family in Ethiopia during the summer, as he always did, and immigrate from Ethiopia, which had easier immigration restrictions. In May 1998, a war broke out between Eritrea and Ethiopia. His family was shortly thereafter kicked out of Ethiopia and deported back to Eritrea. And we had no way to get him out of Eritrea.
He was going to Ethiopia, then leave from Ethiopia. Simple, like what Jane said. But we have assembly time in school, like other schools, and somebody elbowed me. Did you hear the war started? My heart sank. And the war is like maybe 55 miles from where we were. We were around the border. Wow, so I'm not going to leave from this country. And it was it's nightmarish time. The war started in 1998, and in May 2000, it was like the whole country was at war and the teachers had to be taken. So I had to go. And it was very bad time. Jen was on her way to Eritrea. I had to go to national service. And it was like crazy. At one point I'm happy, but second, she's not going to see me. I'm going to be in the camps. But we still kept writing there while I was in the camp.
But in 1998, when we first started thinking about getting married, it was really more like kind of a marriage of convenience, but not convenience to get him here, convenience to bring him here so that we could see where our relationship went. But then by 2000, after he got pulled into military service, nobody knew the direction the war was going to take. The fighting was the worst that it had ever been. In hindsight, it only lasted a few months and it was fine. And by the time he finished his training, the war was over. But that was a really tense summer because we didn't know that at that time. So that to me was like the really crystallizing moment. So when he came back from training, it was just so clear. It was like, yeah, we're getting married. And we went out and bought wedding rings. We bought a dress for me to get married in and we started making wedding plans. So that was like, it's really when you're afraid of losing someone, it makes it really clear that you want to be with them. So we're planning a wedding and Hermias just finished military training. We didn't think anything else bad could happen. The war was over. And then the government decided to transfer him from this larger town in the desert on the coast to this really tiny, remote, in the middle of nowhere place in the middle of the desert along the coast of the Red Sea. Now, we wanted to get married in the town that we met in because all our friends were there, but we couldn't get married in this town that they transferred him to because we didn't know anyone. There was no family there, and transportation to get there was just impossible. So there was no way to have a wedding there. So he got 2 weeks of leave to go to the capital, and we got married in the capital of Eritrea, in Asmara, where his immediate family was, but he didn't have a lot of family. We didn't have a lot of friends there. So we had like 2 weeks to plan a wedding, which meant that it could not be stressful. It just had to get done. And we also didn't have huge numbers of people to invite or a lot of really heavy family expectations. So we could just invite kind of random people who we knew and liked, like the guy who owned the bar where we hung out, the guy who ran the pension where we used to stay. So it was really fun and it wound up being a really great celebration. People praised our wedding because it was so short, because it lasted 5 hours, not 3 days.
Yeah, it was very short and it was good. And I have issues with Eritrean Ethiopian weddings. They last long, they don't get finished. Ours was like 4 hours, 5 hours done. I was relieved, but families were taught.
I love Eritrean weddings. when we were living there, everyone was the age to get married. So we got to go to lots of weddings. But I love weddings where you're like going from one village to another village and it takes all day and people get lost on the way and they're running late and it takes forever. I love Eritrean weddings. I was a little bit sad that we couldn't do a sort of more traditional drawn out Eritrean wedding. He was relieved, but I was really happy. So.
I'm okay with that. Yeah.
I was in graduate school by then, so I was traveling back and forth during my winter break and during my summer break. And then I moved back there in 2003. And then we were there for 2 years, and then finally we were able to figure out how to get permission for him to leave. Thousands of people flee Eritrea illegally every month, in part because it's a very oppressive country, and in part because the government doesn't allow people to leave legally in very many cases. They've loosened up a little bit since then, but it's really a very repressive place. So even though Ermias was finished with his national service and he'd done all of his obligations, they still wouldn't give him an exit visa to leave. So finally, around the same time I was back here visiting, and we'd been trying to get pregnant, and we hadn't been successful. And I was talking to some people here who said, you know, it's probably the stress of having to live in those circumstances. You don't know if you're ever going to be able to get your husband out of this country, and sort of suggested that would they let you leave if you said you needed fertility treatments. Meanwhile, Ermias was also talking to a friend of ours who was a doctor there who said, you know, you might try this. I've heard that a few people have been able to leave for fertility treatments. So we called each other. We're like, hey, should we try this? And so we decided that. So we did, and we had to go through a long, long process, but they did let us leave for fertility treatments. And we were able to come to the US, and we have two beautiful children. So it all ended up well. We never had a problem with U.S. immigration. And I expected when we were coming into the U.S. that we might have some problems, but we didn't. They just sort of waved us in. I don't know if it would be like that today or not. So much has changed. But that was a kindness of the universe to us, because we'd had so many problems on the other side that I never expected. There was nothing in my upbringing that gave me the psychological resources to deal with having loved ones in a war-torn country or dealing with a country that was so repressive that they wouldn't let someone leave. Yeah. So the one kind thing was that the U.S. did not give us a hard time, which was, I think, just sort of lucky in a lot of ways. It could have gone a really different direction.
Many people thought actually our problem was the U.S. embassy.
Oh,
because
yeah.
In most countries, it's the U.S. embassy. Your country says, we don't care.
You know, one of my huge frustrations through that whole time period was when I would come back to the U.S. and people would ask me, like, what's going on? Why isn't your husband here yet? And I would say, well, you know, he's not, the Eritrean government still won't give him the exit visa. And people just wouldn't hear me. They'd be like, oh, it's such a shame that U.S. immigration is so difficult. And I would repeat myself to the same people again and again, but people just couldn't grasp that we're the only country that has the power to limit people's movement, that other countries get to do that too.
Yeah.
It was it's such a foreign idea for everyone that they just couldn't get their heads around it. One of my great sadnesses is that I'd always envisioned that we take the kids back regularly and a kind of back and forth life like I had when Ermias was stuck there and I was going back and forth, that would sort of be our kids' life and they'd sort of grow up bicultural and in both places. And because of the politics, we really haven't been able to do that. But also the Eritrea that we knew isn't really there anymore. Almost everyone we knew and were close to is gone by now, which is really striking to think like your whole community has sort of, if they were able to, have up and left the country. So even if it does get to a point where the politics resolves itself, we will go back and we'll hopefully spend more time there, but it won't be the same place that it used to be.
It's unbelievable how many of my staff members are here or in another country. Everybody left. It's just unbelievable. People are leaving. If there is war and thousands leave, that's one thing. There's no war now. But people are leaving. And they are leaving through the borders. Many die. And people are not revolting. Not because they don't want to. They are scared. If there is war in that country had already fought 30 years of war with Ethiopia, and they don't want to go back. But I still have my cousins, my uncles there. My brother is in D.C., and I have a sister in Rome, but I have one brother there. My parents passed away 5 years ago. After we left from Eritrea, we were not able to get back. So my parents were not able to see our children. They talked to Yona on the phone. I used to send them videos The good thing is, at least they saw us getting married. And at the same time, life is cruel. When my brother was going to get married 1 week before my mom passed away. But she knew he was going to get married. It's like good and bad, but people have seen worse than that in Eritrea. We are very lucky. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I keep asking friends who come here one question. What did you feel when you wake up the next day? And all of them say, oh my God, I'm free. Going to CVS from our house, how many, 3 blocks, one day I said, oh, okay. This is after I lived here for a long time. No one asked me ID in this country. I could have been asked for IDs for that distance. Or somebody will show up, a military.
There's checkpoints everywhere.
Checkpoints. And the moment it's automatic, you pull your ID. Yeah, that doesn't work today. They take your ID, climb that truck, and you'll be taken somewhere, detained for half a day. You don't know why. You get very angry, and you are not the only person. You will see hundreds of people locked in a big compound. Later on, you will learn they are trying to find two people. That's how much tense that country can be. When I was in college, one Haitian girl said she became aware of her blackness when she came to America. No one said anything in that class, but I knew what they were thinking. You haven't seen white person before? No, that's not it. Why do you bother about your skin when there is no racism in your country? There could be ethnic division and stuff. But when you are told one day, even if you are not told verbally about your color of your skin, then you start to wake up and become self-conscious. I woke up a lot about racism, much more than I knew. So you know about racism everywhere, and colonialism, of course. But when you are there inside, you feel it. But the way you handle it can be different. And for me, I try not to think about it in most cases. Maybe I'm protecting myself. When it happens, I'll face it like thing. But I don't know. I don't know what other people say, but this is what I think.
I think when we first came here for a few years, we were so relieved to feel free of the sort of everyday possibility of being detained or the police checkpoints or the military checkpoints and everything that we felt safe, right? So we didn't really think about these more subtle things. But then after a few years, you get used to the feeling of safety and then you start to notice all of those little everyday stressors. I'm terrified of the police when Hermes is out late at night and driving a car. And it's great that he's generally had good interactions with the police. But I also know that his stance towards military police officials, there's a lot of anger there that I think comes from where you come from. And I hear it come out of you sometimes. And I just sort of live in fear that sometimes there's going to be a less positive interaction with the police. And this anger at like the military regime in Eritrea is going to come out in that interaction and it's going to end really badly. So that's what I think about all the time.
In terms of police, mostly I didn't have any problem. Actually, I had 2 minor car accidents. The police were very, very helpful, trying to be patient with my accent. But you see, at different places, you see, they're like, why are you here like thing? But that doesn't really bother me.
There have been some very definite moments when you were really upset. Times when someone's crossed the street, when you've been walking down the street in our neighborhood, when it's clearly racial, that they're reading you as someone who's scary. Times when you don't get treated properly in a restaurant.
In a restaurant.
Or picking up takeout food or something like that. Just all the everyday little slights that you can, like you said, you just sort of try to take them in stride, but they build up and they affect you.
Yeah,
and
you get
angry. They're not right.
Yeah, you pay, you are bringing the same bill, and 3 people run away from you and stand behind the counter. And I just laugh because I just want to let them know I'm a man. What is this? But it's you see it. People come this way. and you are coming this way. And they just diagonally crossing the road and going that way. And if you are afraid of people this much, you are not going to have a good life.
I sort of caught myself at one point, I don't remember how old our oldest son was, when I realized I'd been like pulling back on talking about race and slavery and the American history of racial violence because I thought he was too innocent. And then I sort of woke myself up and I was like, but he could potentially be a victim of this violence. So I've struggled with like, where's that point of breaking down that innocence and realizing that you do need to have those conversations and they can't be protected from what the world is. But I haven't yet completely figured out how to do that.
Yeah, talking about police.
Yeah, that's a...
Yeah, I tell you now, not every police is nice. When you see police, it will not happen to you now, but you have to know how to talk to them, how to not to cut them when they speak to you, and tell them what you think properly in a nice way. And just because they have shiny car, they are not nice. Because they have stress too. They never know what will happen to them. But the thing is, I'm not sure if biracial children maybe, but I'm not sure if, for example, Americans born to Ethiopian or Eritrean or Sudanese or Chinese immigrant parents are told about that clearly.
It's interesting.
Because I asked some people I know and they had to learn it from friends. So what are immigrant parents thinking about? They don't know it, or they thought maybe they will not be confused by the police as African Americans or blacks?
I don't know. Police are, it's a crazy thing. I mean, I've seen like we have two boys. They idolized police. I think we finally broken that down for them so that they haven't heard them say, do that for a while, but I want to be a police officer and this and that. We don't think about police as dangerous. I mean, since I lived in Eritrea, I definitely started thinking about police as dangerous and military personnel as dangerous. And they can turn on their own people that they're supposed to be supposedly protecting as quickly as anything. And that happens everywhere. But it's hard to break children's sort of romantic ideas of that. And everyone has a different way of going through that. So if you're an immigrant who's come from somewhere like Eritrea or Ethiopia or Somalia, where it's a different extreme, you want to think the police are safe. So I think people have sort of internalized that there's nothing wrong with the police. It's the people doing bad things that there's something wrong with, right? And not realizing that their children are just as vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because the problem is with state violence and police. When we're traveling, airports make me very anxious. And that's why when we go through airports, I want to hold all the passports, especially if we're traveling internationally, especially if we're in a foreign airport, because I want to indicate like, this is my family, because I'm scared he's going to get separated out or he and the kids are. And we've never had that experience, but I always sort of feel like we need to do something to indicate by handing the passports as a group that we are a unit, because that's such a place where you can be treated so differently with such repercussions. And he doesn't like it. He tries to take his passport away because he wants to be independent.
Take your passport in.
And leave me with the children. But yeah, no, I feel like it's just simpler. And I think people do look at you differently. And it does streamline things. I don't often have issues in airports. And other people do, as a matter of course, because of the way they look or because of their name looks funny. And I've heard lots of stories of other people who have had problems in airports who don't look like me. So I am the one who grabs the passports and hands them over as a unit in order to sort of indicate that we're a family together. Mount Airy is a very safe place to be, and it's very tolerant and accepting in that way. It's not as diverse as I'd like it to be. When I grew up there, it was a bit more diverse. It was more socioeconomically diverse. It's become much more affluent in the many decades it's been since then. And I don't think it has quite as much various other kinds of diversity. It definitely doesn't have a huge amount of international diversity. So I do always kind of feel like we're other. And we've got good friends and good neighbors, and I think we're okay with that. But I think about our children a lot. And I'm always looking for experiences and relationships that can kind of affirm their that they're different and they have this really different background, because I want them to know that they're okay. And I want them to have a sense that the norm that they're measuring themselves against isn't necessarily a sort of white middle-class Mount Airy norm, that there's other ways to be in the world. But that seems to sort of be the default. And I haven't quite figured out an answer to that, except to just try to give them as many different experiences as we can. It's part of the reason why we moved to Ethiopia for the year last year, because we can't go to Eritrea. It was the closest we could get. And I thought it'd be a good experience for them to just sort of experience something outside of what they've always known. I don't know if it worked or not.
Yeah, it worked, I think. And sometimes, you know, they might not remember it now, but later on, it's not a small amount of time they spent. It's almost a solid year. So they had friends. And there they saw many things, many places. Actually, they were fortunate to see almost the whole Ethiopia. They have seen every single historic places and stuff. They saw that, which is a great deal. Otherwise, I think it helped them to see there is another country, to see there are grocery stores, people with cell phones, cars, highways, food, and that you cannot throw food there. That is a constant fight here.
Hermes doesn't let the children waste food.
Yeah. And I they
strong
saw
cultural
it there.
Principle.
There are many poor people who don't have a penny, these people. So I think that will help them. And I think they learned something. And I don't know how you can measure it, but they learned. And they saw their family there in Ethiopia too. So they had cousins, my cousin's children. And that helped them, I think.
But Ethiopia is not Eritrea. But the cultures are similar. So it was nice to connect them with some of the holidays are similar and are celebrated in a somewhat similar way. The foods are similar. The way families relate to each other are sort of similar. So that was good, too, to keep them connected. I hope Eritrea becomes the kind of place that they can visit and they become the kind of people who want to visit it. That would be my hope. And that they'd see it as a really positive, complicated place that they somehow have some connection to.
We'd like to thank Ermias and Jen for sharing their story. The Loving Project is available in iTunes, Google Play, and just about anywhere else you find podcasts. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review.
You can find out more about the podcast at our website, lovingproject.com. That's where you'll also find pictures of the couples profiled on the show, more episodes, and links to follow us on social media. I'm Brad Linder.
And I'm Farrah Parks. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project. The Loving Project is a year-long podcast series celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia, the Supreme Court decision that legalized interracial marriage across the United States.
Over the course of 2017, we featured stories from 25 interracial couples. In our next and final episode of the year, we'll discuss some of the things we've learned by talking to those couples and feature some of our favorite moments from those interviews, including some that haven't been included in any podcast episodes. That's coming up next time on The Loving Project.